I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing the case of a Michigan militia who planned to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. This case has, of course, gained a lot of attention due to renewed concerns over domestic extremism and the threat it poses within the United States of America. The plot, however, thickens. Because in July 2021, BuzzFeed reported on the FBI's involvement in this story through the use of informants. Joining us to discuss that aspect of the story and unravel some issues related to the national security state apparatus and the potential for its abuse is Branko Marchteach of Jacobin Magazine. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the details of this story, we'll get right into it at the beginning of the conversation. I don't want to rehash everything. You'll learn all about it in the next hour worth of conversation. With that being said, let's get right to it with Branko Marchteach on the Governor Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot and the FBI. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Branko Marchteach, I hope I pronounced that right, or close enough.
It was pretty good. It was pretty good.
So, Branko, you have an article out in Jacobin from July of this year that I wanted to talk about, entitled "The FBI's Domestic War on Terror is an Authoritarian Power Grab." And for people that missed this story, it's about the right-wing plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and we're finding out some interesting details about that plot. Could you fill my listeners in?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think there was already an indication of some of the stuff before this last BuzzFeed report. You know, if you looked at the original FBI affidavit, there were just certain things that jumped out, like the fact that the person who was supplying the explosives for the plot was an FBI informant, that the actual people who were being charged didn't even have remotely the amount of money they needed to buy these explosives. So they were lent money by another FBI informant, and then there were several other FBI informants and undercover agents mentioned in there. And this report by BuzzFeed kind of filled in a lot of the gaps that were hinted at, but not really filled in, as you would imagine, by the FBI. That basically this plot, very similar to the terrorist plots that were supposedly concocted by Muslims during the Bush and Obama years, probably could not have happened and possibly would not have happened at all without the FBI being there, encouraging, cajoling, supplying all these guys with what they needed to sort of get to where they ended up getting to. So, you know, for example, the BuzzFeed report mentions that a lot of the reason that the militia actually came together in the first place was because the FBI provided money, which let one of the informants kind of organize this meeting between people from very different parts of the country to get together and to meet each other. There was also the kind of ringleader, Adam Fox, who was a guy who at the time was living in his friend's basement and
a literal basement dweller.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And was someone who I think didn't have great prospects in his life at the time, and was infuriated by the closure of gyms in Michigan. You know, he was a big gym guy, and that was really the way that he blew off steam, and seemed to be pretty important for his mental health. And so when that went, that was the thing that got him riled up. But as he kind of became more extreme and you know, you might say delusional, or you know, the stuff he was thinking of was increasingly kind of dangerous and violent, some of these other militia members were kind of, you know, wanted to distance themselves from him, and they said, this guy's getting a little bit out there for us. And actually the FBI informant said no, he's fine, and the informant actually included him in meetings with the militia, you know, to basically assure that whatever they ended up doing would go down a more kind of extreme violent path. So, you know, that's kind of two examples there. But if you read the report, there's a whole bunch of other information in there about how integral the FBI was to this plot, you know, ever getting off the ground, let alone kind of getting to where it ended up going.
Now, I'm seeing two reports at the BuzzFeed website. One is from July 12th. That's entitled, "The FBI allegedly used at least 12 informants in the Michigan kidnapping case." And I think the second one is called "Watching the Washman." Both are by Ken Bessinger and Jessica Garrison. And I would highly recommend listeners read those, as well as your article in Jacobin. What sort of drew you to write about this? Because you've actually written about the FBI before, particularly about their COINTELPRO programs.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the most kind of likely threat of authoritarianism in the United States, you know, there's definitely these far-right groups are dangerous. And it is, you know, it is scary when some members of the far-right start to kind of enter or even infiltrate government entities. But at the end of the day, it's as it often is in you know, totalitarian or authoritarian societies, it's way overpowered security agencies that sort of, you know, take national security as their main thing, and you know, say, well, civil liberties and all the rest of it is not as important as us making sure that people are protected. That tends to often be either the starting point or really the nexus even of you know, authoritarianism, of how a country kind of veers away from democracy into something a little more dangerous. And so I, you know, that's what I partly do with the stuff I write about. I keep an eye on this stuff and I try and kind of ring the alarm and warn people. And when I saw this, you know, I think like most people, I heard and saw the original reports. It was very kind of shocking. You see these videos, these guys with these big guns and all, you know, clad in body armor, they're training, and it looks very scary, right? And that was the way that it was reported. But, you know, I, as a journalist, I try to have a critical eye on things and, you know, be a little bit skeptical even of things that kind of, you know, might flatter my own biases and prejudices. And so I had a read of that FBI affidavit. And when I did, as I mentioned before, things jumped out at me as being very similar to stories I had read about back in the Obama years and earlier, of the FBI finding these Muslim men who were you know, down on their luck, you know, to say the least. Guys who really very little prospects for the future, didn't have jobs, weren't particularly well off financially. And in some cases, even were mentally and intellectually disabled.
Are you familiar with Trevor Aronson, The Terror Factory?
I'm not, unfortunately, but that sounds interesting.
He's written a whole book on that subject of sort of entrapment, the FBI, and Muslim terror plots. It's called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. It's not a conspiracy book. I know people will see the title and say Manufactured War on Terror does catch the eye, but he's talking about the exact same thing. There's even cases where you have them going into the mosques and sort of encouraging sort of extremist ideology.
Yeah, there's a famous case of the FBI informant who it was either FBI or NYPD. I can't quite remember now, but he would go to mosques and say crazy things. You know, it's to, in order to kind of supposedly to draw out you know, other extremists. And say, oh, you know, we need to, you know, attack the country, yada yada yada. And then it was so extreme and scary that the members of the mosque themselves actually called the authorities on him because they thought, well, this guy's, you know, out of control. So yeah, I mean, that shows you how in the process of kind of, you know, ostensibly trying to weed out terrorists, these guys end up going way too far and you know, going into some dangerous places. But yeah, I mean, you know, so I think the other thing is as well, there had been since the war on terror, you know, the powers and the budgets and everything of, you know, domestic security agencies have been growing and growing and growing, in a very alarming way. And I noticed as well that over the, Trump years, the kind of rationale for a lot of the worrying authoritarian stuff that we've been hearing under Obama and Bush, you know, ideas to censor the internet, censor the free flow of information, or to even pass a kind of domestic anti-terrorism statute, Muslim extremists stop being the main kind of justification for this, the main kind of boogeyman for this. And it started to be, you know, far right terrorists who, you know, I want to stress, are obviously bad, and that is an alarming thing, an alarming development over the past, you know, 20 to 30 years. But nonetheless, you know, it's a question of, you know, if we didn't want to have the censorship of the internet, when it was Islamic extremists that sort of were in everyone's mind as the big scary threat, do we want to do the same thing, you know, with a different kind of a different ideology behind the terrorism? And so I think, you know, that was the other part of it. I noticed this trend and I wanted to kind of highlight this, that, hey, you know, that there is a push for kind of more authoritarianism right now. And we, you know, we shouldn't swallow it immediately just because in this case, the targets are kind of being presented as people that we on the left typically think of as very unsympathetic or even, you know, repugnant.
So that leads me to the next question then. You know, the common refrain I hear when we talk about cases like this is, well, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Why do I care if the national security state goes after so-and-so? Because they're always going to go after us anyways on the left. How would you respond to that? Because I have issues with that type of response. I actually think the domestic sort of surveillance state is getting worse and we're empowering it more and more. But I know some people that will say, well, it's already at its zenith. I think it has the potential to get much worse than where we're even at right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now the U.S. has, you know, probably the most vast and expansive surveillance state in human history. When you think about things like X-Keys Corps and the other stuff that Snowden revealed. Yeah, I mean, I get that response anytime I write about this. You know, oh, well, why should I care? You know, whatever, let them do it. And you know what? They're going to go after us anyway. Well, okay. But I mean, if that's true, then why care about this issue ever at any point? I mean, you know, it's not as if the left and kind of liberals and you know, people who are concerned with civil liberties, they weren't defending the civil liberties of Islamic fundamentalists during the Bush years because they thought these were great guys. You know, the September 11 hijackers weren't good dudes. They may be historical and political context that explain why they did what they did, but I mean, you know, they still wanted to murder innocent people, you know, including Muslims. So it's not as if, you know, these are fantastic people who we feel, you know, have gotten a bad rap. It's the whole point was that if you let these very unsympathetic characters be the reason that you start to erode civil liberties, due process, you know, and to inflate the power of, you know, various authoritarian segments of the government, of the state, that could eventually be turned on people who you do find sympathetic and you do agree with. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the war on terror architecture during the Bush years was not only aimed at terrorists. It was aimed at, you know, famously, there was an Al Jazeera cameraman who was imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay for years, and a completely innocent man. There were ordinary law-abiding Muslims who were targeted. There were various dissidents of all kinds. And, you know, we saw, I think, very viscerally what that eventually leads up to over the summer last year, really over the whole of 2020, when the George Floyd protests exploded. And we suddenly saw this vast security apparatus that was supposed to defend against terrorists, right, against foreign attacks on U.S. soil. It was turned on the population itself that was protesting, that was dissenting. You know, most vividly maybe in Portland, where, you know, you had nightly confrontations between these police that were kind of geared up and looked like they were going into a war zone in the Middle East, and, you know, who were firing tear gas into crowds of ordinary Americans. So, you know, this idea that they're going to come after us anyway, you know, if you really believe that, then don't bother dissenting ever. I mean, why be outraged about Trump doing stuff? I mean, they're going to go after you anyway, right? I don't believe people really believe that. I think people are saying that to justify not caring about this particular thing, because no one wants to, if you're on the left, no one wants to be seen as if you are, you know, sympathetic or, you know, even defending in some way, whether it's kind of Trump voters or, you know, white supremacists or other far right people. It's kind of distasteful. But you know what? The people that are the first to get this stuff to you know, justify all these erosions of civil liberties, just as it was during the 30s and the 40s when it was first aimed at Nazis before being turned on communists and socialists. It's always people who are in some way unsympathetic and who are in some way repugnant, you know, because no one will object to that, and that's what we have to push up against.
I want to get into the informant issue, because I think there was a high number of informants involved in this Michigan case. But first, I mentioned COINTELPRO earlier. You've written a little bit about that in the past. For listeners that may have heard that term, I even know people that think it's just a conspiracy theory because they haven't read enough about it. What was COINTELPRO?
Yeah, by the way, if you think it's a conspiracy theory, I mean, there was a movie made, very recently called Judas and the Black Messiah that is, you know, it's a fictionalized version, but it's all about that. COINTELPRO was a program set up by the FBI to basically go after the dissent in the United States. I mean, you know, that wasn't how it was sold or justified internally. You know, the idea was it was supposed to stop, you know, kind of the dangers to national security that were internal. But, you know, what those dangers were ended up being, you know, civil rights leaders and activists and various other people, you know, anti-war protesters and the like. And so COINTELPRO aimed to disrupt these groups by infiltrating them and by, you know, trying to sow chaos within all these different movements, turn them against each other, create a sense of paranoia among them, basically, you know, make them eat each other from the inside. But also it was aimed at potentially doing this exact kind of stuff, doing things like goading or encouraging groups to do something potentially violent, which that the FBI could then use as a justification to crack down on a particular group, arrest people, so on and so forth. You know, there's countless examples. I think maybe the most famous one that people know is Martin Luther King, who, you know, famously the FBI tried to blackmail him because of the affairs he was having. They encouraged him to kill himself, so on and so forth. The movie I mentioned to you, that's about the killing of Fred Hampton. The FBI and its files talks about the importance of stopping a messiah-like figure from emerging in the African-American community, you know, out of civil rights movements and out of groups like the Black Panthers. And of course, Fred Hampton ultimately was assassinated, in Chicago by the police. And you know, you have other examples. I've unfortunately forgotten the actress's name, but there was a famous actress who was harassed by the FBI to the point of she was involved with a Black Panther member, and she was generally, you know, she did things with the Black Panthers, they harassed her so much that she ended up having a miscarriage, and it was a very traumatic event for her. She ended up, I think, trying to commit suicide several times on the anniversary of that miscarriage until she finally did.
Gene Seberg.
Yeah, there we go. It finally came to my mind. So yeah, there's you know, a lot of really awful episodes of that. I mean, that's really just scratching the surface. It was a vast multi-decade campaign.
Now, the other issue at hand is, I think they were looking over your article, there were 12 informants in this Michigan case. And, you know, I think the issue of informants is really important to look at. And I think, well, I would say that there's a problem of snitch rackets when it comes to informants. I mean, even before the war on terror, in either of its forms, with domestic terror or with the threat of jihadi terror, I mean, you look at the FBI and how it dealt with organized crime, and you have some incidents such as Gregory Scarpa and most famously Whitey Bulger being involved as informants. And, you know, it seems like they got away with a lot of things while they were informants. So I often wonder how effective this sort of informant game is in stopping these things.
Yeah, I mean, well, as you say, obviously it gives cover to a lot of bad people. I mean, you look at the actual terrorist attacks that have happened in the United States, despite this network of informants and undercover agents and this massive surveillance state that was set up that basically collects every single thing we do online, and tracks our movements, all this stuff. Terrorist attacks still happen. The terrorists are often known to security agencies beforehand. There was a book that came out a few years ago, The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, about how, there is evidence that some of the 9/11 hijackers were themselves CIA informants, and that maybe why they were let into the country. Because the FBI didn't want to let them in, but the CIA said, you know, these guys are fine, with disastrous consequences. So yeah, there's a real question about how useful this is, let alone, you know, whether it's a good idea, on the kind of basis of ethics. Right now, similar to what we're just talking about now, we've recently found out that the FBI was keeping as informants members of the Proud Boys, including the leader, one of the leaders of the Proud Boys, that he was serving as an informant for them for years, informing on anti-fascist and left-wing groups, which makes you wonder. I mean, it brings up the very good question: if the FBI had informants in the Proud Boys who took part in the Capitol riot, how did they not know what was going on? Why was there such a security failure on that day? A security failure that now, subsequently, is being used, even though it was completely avoidable if they just had enough people there to do proper crowd control and to stop people from getting in. But now it's being used to justify all manner of putting more money into the Capitol Police, turning terrorism into a nationwide focus for law enforcement, homegrown terrorism, and actually turning the Capitol Police into this kind of quasi-national terrorist fighting force, where they now have offices in a few different states, conveniently, while they're also exempted from FOIA. You know, very, very good questions that not many people are asking.
I was just going to add to that. What I find interesting about all this, I think that there will be people listening to this that'll say, are you saying there was some type of conspiracy? And you know what? You even say in the article, none of this points to a deliberate conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the watchdogs didn't bark. I've had Ray and John Duffy both on this show to talk about their book on 9/11, and they're not really pointing towards a conspiracy either. I think at most, you can at least say that that book and a lot of these cases that we're talking about, point towards really terrible incompetence, and, you know, no one is ever held accountable. So, you know, to me, that's another big issue in all of this is, well, if we could stop these threats, if there was prior warning, where are the heads rolling? You know, where's the accountability?
Yeah, I mean, that is a common thing, is that these agencies screw up, or they're incompetent, or, you know, whatever. And then rather than admitting to it and saying, oh, whoops, you know, our bad, we that shouldn't have happened, that's on us. Instead, they use that screw up to then say, actually, what we need is more powers and more resources, which then they, you know, end up eventually one way or another training on, yeah, sure, legitimate targets, but also people who are just protesters, activists, dissenters, so on and so forth. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, as you say, you don't have to believe in conspiracies to think that, you know, that something is off about the story and that, you know, this is being used, this kind of mistake that was made is being used to you know, as a bit of a power grab. On the other hand, I would also say that, you know, like, people shouldn't just because something it might be a conspiracy doesn't mean it can't be true. I mean, there are conspiracies. You know, the Bush administration lied about weapons of mass destruction. It wanted to get rid of Saddam one way or another, and it made up an entire architecture of lies. And people within the government, you know, were instrumental in pushing forward this lie. So conspiracies do happen. One of the other examples I give in that piece is that in the recent reporting about Julian Assange that was broken by an Islamic newspaper, they point out that the U.S. government, in order to get into Iceland and talk to this guy who was a part of WikiLeaks, that they wanted to turn into an informant.
This hacker named Siggy, right?
That's right. Yep. And so they needed a kind of pretext. They needed a reason to get into Iceland to be able to talk to him. And the pretext they used was a hacking operation that was done by this hacker that he had known. But it turns out that guy himself was an FBI informant. And so, you know, I have no idea. I'm not saying that the FBI told him, hey, do this, hack the Icelandic government so we can get in. I don't know. But I mean, it would be kind of surprising if they didn't at least have some idea that was coming. And, you know, and they basically said to themselves, well, you know what? Great. Good for us, because this will give us what we need to come in. You know, and the Islamic government eventually expelled the FBI because they realized, hey, wait a minute, these guys aren't here to you know, on the basis that they told us. They're here for their own purposes. So, you know, yeah, it's not necessarily a conspiracy. And most of the time, the explanations for this stuff end up being a lot dumber than people think. But, you know, I mean, conspiracies do happen. So, you know, until we get some sort of good explanation and evidence, I don't think we should rule anything out.
So one thing that really stood out to me about your article was, you know, we should be concerned about right-wing mobs and, you know, militias and whatnot. I mean, we saw what happened with Timothy McVeigh, but at the same time, I think the national security state apparatus, left unchecked, basically always prizes what you call, you know, law and order, which I've always seen law and order as sort of a dog whistle in some ways. But I think it's a real problem that we have on the left dealing with this issue. I mean, we have to consider the issue of civil liberties and the issue of how feeding more resources and more power to the national security state could backfire on us. I mean, I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll say a couple of points. And, you know, when I have made this before, sometimes people get angry at me because they think that I'm, you know, in some way saying that, you know, right-wing, far-right people, groups, terrorists, all that stuff don't matter. But here's a few things to consider. During the Bush years and during the Obama years, people on the left often point out that look, terrorism is bad and it's scary and we need to stop it. But also, it's not that big of a threat to life. If you actually look at the numbers, other than September 11, which is a very unique event and happened because of very specific security failures that really should not have happened at all, terrorism kills very few Americans every year. And that's the case whether it's Islamic extremists in the 2000s and the early 2010s. And it's the same case with you know, the far right now, who are the biggest purveyors of domestic terrorism, but nonetheless are not, you know, it's climate change, for instance, is a far, far, far bigger threat. The amount of people killed by the police in the United States is vastly more than the amount of people the terrorists kill. So that's number one. Number two, you know, why do people turn to the far right? Why do people turn towards any sort of violent extremism? You know, as people on the left, we understand that people are, yes, people have agency, but they're also driven by the social, political, economic, cultural conditions around it. We understand that with crime, we understand why violent crime can happen in certain communities or can be particularly pervasive in certain communities. And, you know, we understand it's not just because, well, these are just bad people. They're just evil people. And so therefore, there's just something wrong with them. We understand there's reasons why people are driven to that. And it's the same thing with violent extremism, whether it's you know, the Muslim variety. We know that there's foreign policy plays a role. We know that these people's social isolation and dislocation and general lack of future and prospects, that plays a role. And I think it's a very similar thing with these far right people. You know, I mean, and people who have stable lives and who things are going well for them, they don't decide to try and kidnap a governor or, you know, try and, you know, potentially assassinate a congressperson. That happens to someone who there's something profoundly wrong in their life. And so you know, a good example is the guy who was found in the van, who had all the, you know, he had bombs and he wanted to kill various people in Congress, including Nancy Pelosi and all these other people, and who, it turns out, had been had his house foreclosed on by Steve Mnuchin, the former Treasury Secretary, back when he was, you know, before he was in government, when he was just a pillaging finance chief who was using the foreclosure crisis to snap up as many homes as possible and kick people out of their homes. You know, so we know that conditions push people into these things. So what is the better way to deal with and prevent far-right terrorism? Is it to empower a national security state that will and has and will again inevitably be turned on, you know, legitimate protest and dissent, and give more funding and power to police who already kill, you know, 1,000 people, 1,000 Americans every single year, many of them black and brown? Or do we focus on attacking the kind of conditions, the root causes that drive people towards these directions, you know, and in the process also secure economic justice for all manner of groups who maybe have not been ended up resorting to violence, but nonetheless suffering under those same conditions? I would say that the second one seems a lot more preferable and I think a lot more effective in my view. So that's how I would look at it.
So there's just two more things I wanted to get into. First, I always like getting into this sort of issue of where are taxpayer dollars going, right? And I mean, one of these informants, as you point out, was paid nearly $55,000 by the FBI for 7 months of work on this Michigan militia case. Is there a case to be made that we're seeing a misallocation of the taxpayer dollars?
Yeah, definitely. And also you might think about like what kind of incentives that creates. I mean, if you're getting tens of thousands of dollars and a new car and all this other kind of stuff from the FBI, which as the BuzzFeed report points out, you know, the amount that one informant was getting paid was well over the median, you know, household income in Michigan. If you're getting that kind of money to, you know, give the FBI information about threats to you know, get people to kind of indulge in their wildest, most violent fantasies, you are incentivized to keep doing that, you know, to push it further. because, you know, if these guys all sit around sort of, you know, talking about, you know, making big talk about all the terrible things they're going to do, and at the end of the day, they just, you know, they've blown off the steam and they go back home and you know, they watch TV and nothing happens. Well, you know, that means you don't get that money anymore. You're not getting paid by the FBI anymore. And yeah, I mean, in terms of the misallocation,
that's what I meant earlier, by the way. I think it creates a bit of a racket.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and that was the same when the targets were Muslim guys. I mean, it was the same exact thing. These guys are being paid lots of money to basically convince these guys who, you know, would say on a message board, or they would say, you know, in person, oh yeah, I'm gonna bomb that mall, or yeah, that's right, I'm gonna bomb that school, or, you know, I'm gonna show these people. But then when push came to shove, they would kind of go, oh, I don't really want to do that, and the informant would have to go to really encourage them. They had to really get them to do this stuff. And yeah, with the misallocation of resources issue, it's like I was saying just before, $50,000 or you know, whatever money is being used by the FBI or the police is being now poured into hiring more police and so on and so forth. It's the point that people who have been, you know, who are in favor of defunding the police or reallocating police sources have been making. This money, we know that more police in the streets does not necessarily actually solve crime. We know that harsher punishments, jails filled with more people, that does not actually solve crime. It's root causes. And so would this money be better spent putting it into programs to you know, anti-poverty programs, or, you know, to mental health or social work? Again, I would argue that yes, that's exactly where it should go.
So the last thing I wanted to mention, when I look at this Michigan militia case, I also think of incidents from the past, like Waco or Ruby Ridge, which I feel like those were cases where even more effort should have been made to de-escalate things, and things got really out of hand. And I think it actually made, you know, martyrs out of people like the Weavers and the Branch Davidians. And then that led eventually, I think, to the Oklahoma City bombing. It created these martyrs that emboldened more extremism and this idea of, oh, the government is coming out to get us. I think the same could be said with this Michigan militia case. I assume the elements of the far right look at this and say, well, we're right, the government's coming after us, see what they're doing. And things like this, I think, actually can create a feedback loop of blowback. I think it can often embolden domestic extremism when this news comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. A lot of these groups, I mean, the guys in the particular militia that were involved in the Michigan kidnapping plot, a lot of outlets have kind of just called them white supremacists, because that's just sort of the assumption is, well, if they're, you know, harbor some kind of like anti-government feeling, they must be white supremacists. It is not really an indication that all these guys were white supremacists. In fact, a bunch of them actually supported the Black Lives Matter movement. What they were animated by was anti-government sentiment. You know, they saw the government as trampling on their rights, particularly with the lockdowns. They saw the government as a threat to American liberty. You know, there's obviously a very long American tradition of that kind of thinking. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. If the government starts, you know, partially manufacturing these plots, which it then uses to arrest these guys, and uses to make the argument to give itself more power, a lot of that power being you know, power to oppress, to you know, to repress things that they see as politically wrong, politically, you know, inconvenient or what have you, politics that they disagree with, then yeah, there is a potential, I think, for a radicalizing effect to happen, for people to go, other anti-government people to, you know, point to that and say, well, look at that. I mean, we're right. The government is coming after us. They are trying to stop us, which, you know, I mean, look, we'll see. Thankfully, that I think did not happen so much with Muslim extremism. Islamic based extremism, whatever you want to say.
Also, to be fair, I think I mentioned Ruby Ridge and Waco. I don't think we've seen incidents like that since then. I mean, even there's been similar incidents, right? You know, the Bundy Ranch, the Ed and Elaine Brown case, but it never devolved into, you know, that kind of incident. So I guess I have to give credit where credit is due in that regard, but you know, these things, one false move can really have catastrophic consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in the country of the US where people are heavily armed, and in many places it's completely legal to walk around wielding, you know, all manner of insane and dangerous weaponry. So, you know, I mean, you know, that the stuff that some of these guys participated in during the Michigan, you know, the storming of the Michigan Capitol back when the lockdowns were first implemented. I mean, that was alarming stuff, you know, because it's not like, you know, these guys were ever going to take over the Capitol. But if the police hadn't shown the restraint they had, a restraint that they, by the way, never showed to, you know, anti-police brutality protesters. But if they hadn't shown that restraint, you know, things very could have easily spiraled out of control, you know, and there could have been shooting and death and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think you're correct.
In closing, do you think there's any potential reforms that could be made when it comes to these national security style agencies in the future? I know that's it's a speculative question, but...
I mean, it's an interesting question because that's almost an entire topic of its own. I mean, I think there's a real question of if you're someone on the left, is there a role in a kind of, you know, in a kind of government that you know, whether you're socialist or progressive or, you know, whatever, anything, you know, on either side of that. Is there a role for some sort of security agency, whether it's, you know, like a CIA type thing that seeks to guard the country from external threats, or if there's, you know, or an FBI style thing that looks for internal threats? And how do you have those institutions? How do you have those entities operating and doing legitimate work without them veering into, you know, the kind of political oppression that both have been engaged with? I think that's a really good question, and I don't know if I can give you an exact answer now, but, you know, I mean, I think yeah, it would make sense to dismantle some of these institutions and rebuild something in its place. You know, I mean, the idea that the CIA has to exist is far from, at least it didn't used to be, a consensus opinion. I mean, the CIA was created for the Cold War, the purposes of the Cold War, similar to NATO, another obsolete institution that has now kind of been, you know, after the Cold War, has been used for completely different purposes. You know, back in the 90s, Daniel Patrick Moynihan put forward a bill to abolish the CIA. Harry Truman, among others, has you know, called for the abolition of the CIA, so it was a dangerous anti-democratic institution. So yeah, I mean, in terms of reforms, I mean, if we're talking about just reforming these entities, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things that could be done. I mean, the CIA has an enormous amount of power to spy on people and a lot of leeway to do all manner of pretty questionable things, as does the FBI. And, you know, like putting that under some very strict limits on that, number one, and actually having some oversight with teeth over some of these agencies, you know, not just kind of to have an advisory role, but something that really reins them in. You know, what would be wonderful, actually, if there was a 21st century version of the Church Commission, you know, that was launched by Frank Church back in the 70s in the wake of all the abuses and everything that came out with Watergate, and looked at, that's how we know about COINTELPRO and so much other stuff, that, you know, that they were able to look at this stuff and explore as what had been happening. And, you know, God knows what's happening now. We have no idea. We're completely in the dark. So that would be a first step. And then once we actually know what these guys are doing, then we can actually start to talk about specifically, okay, well, you know, let's eliminate this. You're not doing that anymore. You should not have the power to do that. You know, I think that would be good. Yeah.
And another really important thing to note here, I mean, The Intercept has reported on, you know, identifying socialists within the military as domestic extremists under Biden. But even before Biden, I mean, look at what Trump, as you point out, used federal agencies to do during his reign. I mean, we had the whole stir about black identity extremists. We had federal agencies going after, as you put it, protesters, journalists, and immigration lawyers. Should we be thinking about that in the future? I mean, right now there's Democrat in office, but what happens when we get someone that's more Trump-like? I don't know, maybe a Ron DeSantis or someone. Should we be worried about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to me is the kind of the most frustrating thing about this whole thing. You know, through all of 2020, we saw this very clear cautionary tale playing out before our eyes. There was this guy that had these authoritarian tendencies in the Oval Office. People were literally calling him a fascist. I mean, a literal fascist, you know, saying that he was the second coming of Hitler. Well, okay, if you really believe that that's true, then why on earth would you want to hand him even more power? You know, Trump went to designate Antifa a terrorist organization, which he was not able to do because he didn't have the statutory power to do it. And people were freaking out at the time until they realized, well, hold on, no, there's no domestic terrorism war. Oof, thank God. We dodged a bullet. And then immediately, before he even leaves office, because of the Michigan thing and then the Capitol riot, these same people start pushing for domestic terrorism war as if, you know, the United States is not a one-party state. It's a country where a change in leadership happens pretty regularly, you know, once every 2 years, and then for the presidency, once every 4 years. And if it's not once every 4 years, you know, politics is cyclical, particularly in the United States. And it's all but guaranteed that a Republican will come to power at some point, and he will inherit all the, even if you think that Biden can do this, use this stuff responsibly, and there's no reason to think that that is the case. But even if you do, well, Biden is not going to be the president forever. And a Democrat is not going to be in the White House forever. It will be Republican eventually. And by the way, that Republican by 2024 could be Trump. I mean, you know, he hasn't gone anywhere. He's very clearly gearing up for another run, and he probably would win the GOP nomination. I mean, you know, he'd be the front runner, certainly. So, yeah, I mean, I'd ask people to really think about that. If you were terrified of what you were watching in 2020, when you're watching Trump do all this really scary authoritarian stuff, then the goal should not be to make sure that he has even more leeway to do more of it if he wins again.
Yeah, I always think there's a chance of a Trump or Ron DeSantis getting into power. I know it's odd because a lot of people I know that are centrists will always go back to, well, it's over for the Republicans now. They're disintegrating, and we have the suburban vote now. It's going to be 40 years of Democratic rule. And I'm like, you may be too short of that because I've been hearing that since I was a little kid. So
that's what they said after 2008. They were saying that in 2016 that Trump, with Trump as the standard bearer, the GOP is finished. And also, if anyone who watched the election results, I don't know how you can believe that. I mean, the Democrats had a cluster of crises that the incumbent was saddled with, you know, an economic crisis unlike many that had been seen in recent decades, and then a once-in-a-generation health crisis, a pandemic that had killed hundreds of thousands of people, and the Democrats lost. They lost seats in the House, and they lost a bunch of Senate races they should have won. So how on earth, if those are the conditions that they lost in, how can people really believe that the Republican Party is done for? I mean, my God, Trump barely lost. Even with everything that was going on, and even with all the stuff he had done to run the country into the ground, it just, you know, completely nonsensical to believe that.
So the note I want to end on, I'm just going to provide this statement, and then you can respond, and we'll wrap it up there. But, you know, I feel like talking about this issue of the national security state and national security state overreach, having too much power, giving too much power to the national security apparatus. It's becoming increasingly controversial. I'll sort of get these responses from people where they'll say, Tucker Carlson's talking about the NSA now, so you shouldn't be attacking the NSA. Or, Glenn Greenwald said, and I just don't care. I don't care about this cult of personality stuff anymore. I don't care what Greenwald said or Carlson. I want to focus on the issues. And it seems like that's become increasingly hard for some people to do. And I don't know about you, but I almost feel like the guy that's in those old horror movies, you know, like the Friday the 13th movies, the crazy guy that's like, we're all doomed. We're doomed, I tell you. That's how I feel these days when it comes to talking about this issue, because a lot of people will give you a lot of pushback for it. But I'm assuming you've also had positive responses as well.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of good positive responses. You know, Edward Snowden, of course, as all writers, I put my stuff out on Twitter. I will, do threads to sort of go over my whatever I write. And Edward Snowden happened to come across one of those tweets and retweeted it, and that got a lot of attention. So that was very good. And, you hear, of course, the loudest people are the ones who criticize or hate what you do, but and it was the people who like or agree tend to be silent. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people kind of shared it around, so it seems like people do agree. I would say for people on the left, right now the United States has really been it's polarized, and not polarized in a good way, by class or kind of income or anything like that. It's being polarized on this very shallow terrain of culture and party, Democrats and Republicans, and the left has to really resist that. You can't just say, "Oh, Tucker Carlson said something, therefore it must be bad." I mean, that's the thinking that people, that liberal people, kind of pro-democratic people, took to Trump and things like Russiagate. If Trump went to get out of Afghanistan suddenly, that must be bad because Trump's doing it. No, you have to think about the issues on their own, isolated from all this partisan noise. Tucker Carlson, for completely cynical reasons, says a lot of things that ostensibly we might agree with. He attacks corporations. He talks about the importance of withdrawing from foreign wars, so on and so forth. Doesn't matter if he's disingenuous or not. That's irrelevant. That shouldn't be what he says and thinks, and that should be completely irrelevant from people's analysis of where they stand on an issue. Ending foreign wars is good, whether or not someone terrible supports it, whether Trump does it or whether it's Biden. Sending people direct checks during a pandemic and during an economic crisis is good, regardless of the fact that Josh Hawley supports it. Don't be drawn into this partisan polarization nonsense that has taken over the rest of the country. It's our job to resist that stuff and stand outside of it.
Well, hey, Branko, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work and what you're doing at Jacobin?
You can go into jacobinmag.com. There's a lot of good stuff on there besides the stuff I write. You can get me on Twitter at B, and then my last name, Marchatich, but with H's after the C's. I don't know if that's a clear enough explanation. And follow some other Jacobin writers as well. Everyone there does really good work that I think people should read.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Branko Marchatich. Please consider reading his work at Jacobin Magazine. And also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. $1, $5, $10, and $15 tiers. Even a dollar will help. $5 tier gets bonus content. I should be releasing some more bonus content, including video interviews and
previous editions of Parallax Views in the next week. $10 and $15 tiers get a producer's credit shout out, and the $15 tier gets, if they're open to it and my schedule allows, access to me for a monthly chat on Skype or Zoom. All you have to do at the $15 tier is shoot me a message and we can work something out if you want to talk. And now, for the $10 and $15 tier supporters, the producer's credit shout-out. Shout-outs to Gunner, Ed, Jamie, James, Orc, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Gratz, Martin, The Warnerd, Emilia, Brian, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's a patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid.